Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Live from the gleaming streamlined studios, state-of-the-art, of AlphaRadioLive.com, nestled in our secret bunker somewhere in the Los Angeles area, the following program is produced with an artistic vengeance by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network.
Yeah, you always get me with that nestled.
Nestled, I know I get
that
you
word
with that
just
nestled.
Kills me. You're the only person that you and Obama, you use nestled.
We That's use it. Nestled, but we don't use Lodestar. I'm on top of it this week.
There goes the end of that show. Beginning and end.
Beginning and end. Where was I? Oh, I remember where I was.
You were telling me.
And I was nestled in a secret bunker.
And who are
I
you?
Am the legendary Burl Bear, the man right there, Howard Lapidus, manager to the star.
Yes, I am.
Just one. It rotates. I knew it hits.
There are more than one.
You always say that, but we have yet to discover any evidence to the contrary.
Speaking of evidence, let's talk about Christopher Darden, if you like. Okay, are we done?
Christopher Darden, it didn't work for him either, did it?
Not even a little bit.
No,
Why did he bring up Christopher Darden?
Because he's desperate for a name drop.
I guess. Boy, that is desperation.
Funk.
Okay.
I heard that one hit the floor so loud the walls shook. Mark C.G. Boyer is over there. Fact checker. Make sure his mic's off.
Certainly did a good job with that O.J. thing, didn't he?
Go back to Nestle, I think.
Yeah. N-E-S-T-L-E-S.
And he's going to do a nice job on his Universal NBC overall deal, but that's fine by me.
Yeah, I'm wearing a pair of those this week.
Good.
My NBC overalls.
That's funny. Oh, there goes your deal.
Speaking of humorous, Gary Grossman's here today.
Oh, God.
If I say, why, when he writes thrillers.
He does, but you know the odd thing about Gary Grossman?
Yeah, I can see him with clothes, for one thing.
How much of a family show is this?
No, it is a family show.
Yeah, through the Manson family.
The truth is Gary and I went to college together.
And
absolutely.
He was 2 years ahead of me.
And they were pinned at the senior prom.
He was the big shot when I was a shot.
By the way, Howard still is.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm still just a shot.
I was reading over his resume today.
Here, it's upside down, though. Really.
Oh, that explains it. In that case, you have produced more than 0.01 TV shows.
I'll fix the paper.
Here we go. All right.
Okay. You're getting funny in your old age, Burl.
Yeah, I know what happens. Senility is so amusing. 10,000 TV shows?
My favorite was 7,451.
What was that? The New Adventures of Flipper?
I actually can't remember. I just remember the number.
This is good.
Yeah, that was Flipper Dissected. That's as far as you could go.
No, you know what it was? Yeah. It was one of the Dr. Drew shows that we did.
Simply
with
Sex.
With Dr. Drew.
On the Discovery Health Network.
At Discovery Health. And
which
then
became the Oprah Network.
Right. And then it changed to Simply Dr. Drew.
Yeah,
because there was concern about
the sex. The
Dr. Drew's sex. I saw that porn film.
Did you?
No.
I didn't think so.
I know. I heard about it, though. Saw a still picture. Where were we? Oh, Gary Grossman writes thrillers. And I think you even went to Thriller Fest.
I did. That's the International Thriller Writers Association Conference in New York. And I've been there, I think, for about 10 years now.
Just waiting
shoulders.
For others to show up?
Well, this year, the big one to show up was George R.R. Martin, King of Thrones. And I'm thinking, maybe I need another initial in my middle name.
Like J.R.R. Tolkien, yeah.
Yep. Gary H.H. Grossman, maybe.
What's your middle name?
Howard.
See? There we go.
That's why you two are linked to the hip.
But I knew that. I had to have him say it.
Let's take a quick glance, shall we, at the titles of some of your best-known contemporary works. You have Executive Actions, Executive Treason. That should be the new one. Executive Command and Executive Force.
New one. That's
Executive
new
Force
one.
Right here. I'll there hold it up to the microphone.
That is the brand new one. It looks exactly like the picture of the cover, except
it
has more pages.
The first page of that book just drags you right into the rest of it.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
That is important.
Yep.
You got to hook them and drag them kicking and screaming. Good, his mic isn't working. Thank you, Matt. You follow directions well.
It's the fourth book in what was going to be just a trilogy.
What do you call a fourth book in a trilogy?
The publisher came up with the term, the fourth standalone thriller.
Oh.
Okay.
So it's not a quadrophenia.
Yeah, I couldn't spell that.
What's the deal with the executive? What are you doing there with...
Well, the executive refers to the executive branch, the presidency. It's also the executive decisions that are made in the United States in all the books, as well as whatever foreign entities we're dealing with. An executive force, the foreign entities, well, it's one in particular, it's North Korea.
Heard of them.
Yes, and you'll read a lot about them in here. They're behind a plot working with separatist groups in the United States.
Figures.
Of which there are, 50 states? At least 50 separatist groups.
But we are in fiction here.
We are not so much in fiction.
Yes. Is this inspired by the actual events and undercurrents current in our society?
Well, what happens when I start writing the unthinkable, which I start with, I end up coming up with what is so far unknowable but real. And my editors are always saying, Gary, you're scaring me a little. I work with the Navy on the climax of this book, and I did some deep research into, no pun intended, submarine warfare. And the commander that I was working with, the public affairs commander, said when I first made the approach, Gary, we can only go so far with what we're helping you with because you've actually stumbled on something that we can't quite discuss. And that's what happens when you start thinking the unthinkable.
That's
so,
right.
So what was that? What was that unthinkable piece that you stumbled upon?
Well,
because
not to,
right. That's public now.
Yes, and not to give away so much the end of the book, but if we're going to punish another country without anyone knowing, at the risk of not having a world war or at least a nuclear war, how can we do it?
Okay.
Well, I think the answer is, and it starts off very in the very beginning of the book, too, the answer is what the Russians have been doing to us. You use bots, you infiltrate computer systems, and you have viruses ready to trigger when you trigger them. So the question is then, how do you trigger devices on a submarine or a submarine force and code it in a proper way, or perhaps an improper way, that they'll take a message and then do just the opposite of what they should be doing? And that's what executive force leads up to. The separatists in the book all the way through, I kind of gave them an interesting group name, USA. United Separatists of America.
Hard to get them to unite, though.
Well, they're united in wanting to dissolve the union and form their own individual unions.
As you no doubt recall, the FBI a few years ago put out a document on what the biggest terrorist threat was to the United States of America. It wasn't Al-Qaeda. It wasn't ISIS. It was exactly what you're talking
about. Separatists.
Yeah.
And every state and every part of the country, Riverside County tried to get other counties in California to separate from California. Texas, Governor Perry threatened in 2009 to take Texas out of the
union. I thought that was a wonderful idea.
It didn't happen yet, though.
Do you know what would happen if they did? I read an article on that in terms of how much of Texas's economy comes from the federal government. And if they were to secede from the union, they would have total economic collapse.
And that usually doesn't make it to the local meetings.
No.
When they're signing people up.
They don't bring that up.
No. But the threats are very real in executive force. Prior to this one, Executive Command was out, and in that novel, and I was on here to talk about it, thank you for having me back, it was water. That's our most valuable and vulnerable natural resource. You don't have to poison water all across the nation. All you have to do is make people fearful that the water they drink is poison, and you can ruin the economy. And you do that at various spots all across the country. And Twilight Zone episode. Absolutely right. In fact, you bring up Rod Serling in Twilight Zone. I teach at Loyola Marymount University, a graduate class in television history. And we're watching right now a lot of Rod Serling's early programming, writing before he did Twilight Zone.
Requiem.
That wasn't his, but Patterns and
Patterns, which deals with big business. Absolutely.
Now, were you gone from Emerson already when he came in as a guest lecturer for a couple of days?
I was gone.
Oh,
and I think he got the Connor Award from from a fraternity.
I believe that's what that was.
Right.
But he did do seminars. And that was one of the great days of my life.
Oh, God, to meet Rod Serling.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Writer. I'll tell you a story about Rod Serling. Los Angeles, just picture Los Angeles, and I don't know how many Starbucks coffee shops there are. Are they coffee shops? What do they call them? And there, you can't throw a stick in any direction. Not that you should throw a stick inside a Starbucks.
Like but yelling stick at a theater.
Shouldn't have a twizzle, maybe. You can't throw a twizzle. But everybody in there are taking it. They're taking up tables, writing their screenplays or writing
especially
their books.
Especially at the one at Beverly Glen.
Larchmont Village, everywhere. I have a rule. I do not sit and write at Starbucks. I just don't do it.
Why not?
Well, interesting thing. I will sit and write at El Coyote, a Mexican restaurant, because they have margaritas. Okay? And anything that I write there always seems so much better than, than if I were just drinking coffee. But
almost went there last night.
But
El Coyote.
Great margaritas, great Mexican food. For the
Sharon Tate.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Sharon Tate, night before. My daughter just told me that a couple of weeks ago. So what I learned while one day I was leaving, another guy was writing there and he said, do you know we're not the only two people who have done this? Well, we were the only two people that day. And he said, yeah, in the 1960s and 50s, when Rod Serling wrote at CBS for the Playhouse 90, for Twilight Zone in the 60s, he would bring his portable typewriter over to walk down the street, go to El Coyote, and write there. So I stayed for another margarita.
Yes.
That was great.
And pretended you were Rod Serling.
I did.
What's he saying?
Say
anybody
again?
No one knows.
You need an additional excuse to stick around.
What in the world is he saying?
I think he's going for humor, and let's just let
yeah,
it
my,
go.
Yeah, my earphone
we'll just let
wasn't,
it go.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it sounded good.
The tapping works. The tapping does work. The voice, no.
So all the books, what I find so interesting is the research. I'm writing, as I describe it, the first draft I don't write. My characters write. It's like a Twilight Zone episode. I sit down and I take dictation from them, and then I do the additional research. The second draft, I write, because I'm rewriting basically what they told me. And with Executive Force, I was describing characteristics of the Supreme Leader, fictionalized only slightly in the book, the Supreme Leader of North Korea. And it started with, and I just have a couple of notes here, it started with what are the big six constellation of personality disorders: sadistic, antisocial, paranoid, narcissistic, schizoid, and schizotypal. And I started then from there going into the United States Army Leader Development Field Manual and looking at what the categories, the danger signs of a leader in any country that you look for, particularly in dictatorships, or just watch the Caine Mutiny and Captain Queeg. There's a diminished grasp of trust and critical thinking, self-awareness, empathy, and likely most important, discipline and self-control. Leaders shape the ethical climate of their organization while developing the trust and relationships that enable proper leadership. Here's where it gets really interesting. A leader who lacks trust can wield power by remaining remote and isolated, by making propagandistic promises and threats, and by eliminating subordinates from the chain of command. Lacks discipline and self-control, impulsive emotional outbursts. In psychiatric circles, it's all about filters, lack of filters, and a lack of empathy, as I mentioned. And what I started finding is that if you look at leaders at any point through history, the ones who lean more towards the dictatorial side are the ones who have these traits. Doesn't mean they're not successful. They could be very successful. But they are the signs that you look for in a leader and whether a leader is going to survive in leadership, which makes Executive Force pretty timely this week. and hopefully for a few weeks.
Yeah, let's root for that because we're really rooting for you. We are.
And thank you.
What the heck got you to sit down in front of the computer the first time? You're a TV guy and a very successful TV guy. Always
well,
was. And that.
Thank you.
And then what happened one day? Well, did it happen a long time?
Why destroy all that to become an author?
No, that's not it at all.
It was one day, and I'll tell you, it started with a meeting that I had. Rob Weller and I were producing partners in Weller Grossman Production for years and years and years, and we worked with Howard on Drew Pinsky shows. We were at the History Channel in New York, and we were having a meeting, and someone in the History Channel meeting, not me, said, "Do you think we're running out of history?" Now, I remember that date because it was September 10th, 2001. We know what happened the next day. Rob and I, 2 days later, got a car to drive back to Los Angeles because no flights. And I started thinking about a plot that might take, I'll back up. If that plot took 7 or 8 years to gestate after the first attack on the World Trade Center towers, what about a plot that would take 20 or 30 or 40 years? And if you waited that long, what would be most valuable? And I thought it was the presidency itself. So how do you make that happen? And I started researching the secret sleeper cell spies, much like if you've seen Red Sparrow, the schools that trained Russians, or you've seen in The Americans, the TV show, the schools that train Russians to pose as Americans. Well, back in the Cold War, that's what they had to do. They had to blend in. They had to learn not to go in and bargain at a supermarket over the food.
Where did you learn that? I mean, you were a teenager in the 60s.
My first political thriller that I read was 7 Days in May, which was a story about a coup d'etat of the White House, an attempted one. And I remember seeing Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove. My parents, my father was in law enforcement, my mother in politics. We were Rockefeller Republicans, New York State, always talked politics. And I had a shortwave radio, and I listened to broadcasts from throughout the world. Radio Moscow, Havana, Cuba, China, BBC, I remember the Big Chimes, a big band on the hour when they would do their broadcasts. So I was aware of the world beyond.
That must have had a profound effect on you, yes?
Absolutely did.
Talk about that.
Absolutely did. I'll go back to a time that a lot of people remember, and that was October 1963 when President John Kennedy came on television. My father was in New York for a meeting. We lived in upstate New York. He worked in Albany. And I remember sitting on the couch with my mother and probably feeling what she felt when she first heard that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor and not knowing what that was going to mean to the rest of her life and her new marriage and her family. And she was very nervous, and I certainly then became scared. Would I see my dad again? Would missiles be flying? All those things gave me the grounding and the foundation of what I do now. And then moving into documentaries and TV news and writing, all the History Channel shows and the A&E shows, a lot of them had a political bent.
I'm going to drag you back
to the
heart of the last question. And that's the profound effect that listening on your shortwave to material coming out of Moscow and Havana, wherever you were getting it, but it was not the United States, and it was different than what you were learning.
Very different.
What was the effect of that? What did you hear? What do you remember?
I remember the propaganda from Radio Moscow and the five-year plans, talking about the five-year plans in agriculture and the five-year plans in industry, and how they were going to advance Russia, and the Russian message was going to be throughout the globe. I remember listening to Voice of America fight that, propaganda to propaganda.
How did they say they were going to do it?
They didn't say how they were going to do it. They were talking about their strength. and their military might and their economic might, all of which ultimately was a lie, with one exception, and that was the fact that they had built up the satellite nations around Russia to protect themselves, to give them a buffer, and to protect themselves against NATO, which they clearly perceived as a very real and present threat to them. And I heard all of that, and I heard of that as a kid. And
scare you?
Scary. I would say I had awareness of it, but it made me a reader.
Well, you were listening to this unbridled by a teacher or a parent.
Correct.
Or somebody that you could just look up and go, help me with this.
Well, I also, at that time, when I was 12 years old, became a ham radio operator.
Mm-hmm.
So not only was I listening, I was communicating,
mm-hmm.
and I could talk. And all of that put me out in the world in a way that most people weren't, in a small Hudson Valley town, Hudson, New York. And I think I was aware. But I do remember listening on the shortwave radio to Sputnik. Beep, 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 mm-hmm. beep, going overhead and looking in the eastern sky as that was going past.
That was, in fact, Russia's first satellite.
Absolutely the first satellite. That was real evidence of what we needed to do. We were behind. We were behind. And even though that wasn't a threat, it felt like a threat. And then Yuri Gagarin becoming the first astronaut.
First man
in space.
He circled the globe.
And we had to play catch up from there. And it seemed like in the Cold War, even though we probably had more military might, it always felt like we were playing catch up. And the threat was real, at least to.
So that's inspired Kennedy to say in 10 years we'll be on the moon.
Absolutely right.
And we were.
And the.
What did that matter?
I was in a control room at WBZ TV in Boston when Neil Armstrong set his first foot on the moon. It really did happen.
Come on, that was a backlot at Warner Brothers. Come on.
Actually, it was Fox. But,
okay.
but all those things were pretty seminal experiences for a kid growing up in a small town. And then the people who would come to town, the Governor Rockefeller would come in there. Gore Vidal ran for Congress when I was a kid, and I got to meet Gore Vidal in my, as I recall, my Cub Scout uniform, going up and shaking hands with him. And I knew he was a brilliant writer, but I never thought I would be writing novels until
that
ride
back.
Were you
in the Hamilton Fish District?
We were.
See?
My mother, very good. My mother was campaign manager for that seat years later that Ham Fish had had.
How do I know that? Follow this. I went and saw Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman in Boston, where mm-hmm. I was going to Emerson. And I had a date, and I had my car. And somehow I sideswiped a car, and I pulled over, and I left my information. And sure enough, the next day, I get a note or a call from Hamilton Fish III.
Right, Chatham, New York. That's where he lived.
I hit his car.
Ah.
So I had to go through the whole process with him and Hamilton Fish, the great
His father, who was a congressman in the 30s,
yes.
and as I recall, was one of those who did not want us to enter World War II.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Ham Fish. Anyway, I digress, but I was wondering if that's where you came from.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I want to get back to something that you mentioned earlier gee, I hate making things about me, but I shared a similar experience. When you're doing research and you come across something that's sensitive because you start thinking, and I wrote a book where I got information from the Navy on what was called Strike Star 2025.
And what was that?
That is how drones can be used to occupy a country. It only takes two to occupy and cause extreme paranoia in any population. And so I was doing the novelization of Stealth with about the rogue, giant rogue going on blowing things up.
How did they do it with two drones? Tell me how they do that.
Because they're very fast. They are stealth.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know where they are. So what you are doing is creating total nationwide paranoia. And that's how you control the population. Well, the movie Stealth had no plot. It had situations, but it didn't have why the bad guys were the bad guys. But it was my job doing a novelization to make that. and Sony had to approve it. Well, I came up with it. Well, you only need two of these things to occupy a country. They're going to occupy a country, except they're going to occupy their own country. They're going to occupy America with the slogan that security is freedom. And they went, no, that's too effing scary. That's too possible.
And it's like the water issue.
Right, exactly.
It is so possible and so plausible
that they don't want to talk about it. And so what I did instead is I said, well, the United States is going to attack Japan, blame it on North Korea, and use that as an excuse to steal all of Japan's proprietary technological information. And they went, Sony, which is Japanese, loved that.
It wasn't the U.S.
Well, blame it on North Korea.
Well, it's so interesting once you start thinking, I'm going to set a plot in another country. And for me in executive actions, it was researching the Red Banner schools, the schools where those spies were taught to pose as Americans. And for North Korea, it's, you know, what we do know that they've done with the internet and viruses. But you start digging into it, and the scary part is we don't know what we don't know. My IT guy at our production company about 12 years ago, when I was... I think the second book was coming out, first book, said, Gary, you should be looking into what the Russians are doing with the internet. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, this is our IT guy. He said, they will have the most dangerous tool on the planet. And it's true.
I always wondered about Videodrome. Did you see Videodrome, James Woods and Deborah Harry many years ago?
No, I didn't see that.
Well, it's a similar concept. This is done like years and years ago, where if you're watching porn, you know, especially really weird porn, you know.
Your kind of porn.
My kind of porn. There's a signal that's being sent that's going to destroy your brain because we want to get rid of those people. Those kind of people, similar to the where Robert Redford played the right-wing fascist in the Captain America movie. And we're going to eliminate all these people.
And what was the movie Telephone with
Charles Bronson?
Charles Bronson.
Boy, but how did I pull that one out of a hat?
Yeah, thank you.
Amazing.
Because it wasn't that with the telephone company.
Right.
It was the phone company that was inserting things in our brains. Well, you start thinking the unthinkable, and that's...
Someone's thought of it.
You start putting sentences together.
Yep.
It's so interesting because I don't know necessarily what I'll be doing for the next book in this series. I do have another book coming out in March called Red Hotel. Mm. And this, actually, I won't get too deep into it, but the discovery, and it's with a writing partner, the discovery of this started while I was walking our dogs one night. And I bumped into a neighbor, a friend, Bruce Feirstein, who coincidentally had written three of the first Pierce Brosnan, James Bond films. And I'd had him on a TV show, and I'd worked with him with Pierce on a National Geographic, on a show that launched the National Geographic Channel. He said, Gary, I have somebody want you to meet. I'm on a board at Boston University with this guy, and he wants to write a novel or co-write a novel. And I said, well, I haven't done that with anyone before, but tell me, what's his story? And he said, well, his name is Ed Fuller, and he just retired as the president of Marriott International. And my reaction was, well, what do I have in common with the gentleman who was president of Marriott International? He said, take the meeting. You just have to get together with him, which I did. And within 30 seconds, I realized he was as much in the anti-terrorism business as the hotel business. His hotels were blown up, Marriott and Ritz, in Mumbai and Jakarta. Mm. He dealt with the fall of Mubarak in Cairo, getting his team out. He was in Libya and Tripoli when Gaddafi fell. So my first question to him, 30 seconds after hearing this, was, who do you have on speed dial? And he told me. And I said, I think we can work together.
Who did he have on speed dial?
Chasey Lane.
Well, when you have to get people out of a country with bad guys having guns, you better have some mercenaries on your side with an airplane. And he did, and cash. And he also developed the five-code color system to protect hotels, international hotels in the world. And it's what was interesting is we visited some other properties in the United States, and it was, you know, when somebody's, you've never had a one kind of car before, and then you get it, and now you see that car everywhere, or you somebody mentions a song that you may have heard a million times, but it never registered, and now that you heard it, you know it. We had talked enough about security in hotels that as I walked with him through these hotels, I began seeing what was wrong with them with security and what needed to be upgraded in cities like Los Angeles.
So what was wrong and what needed to be upgraded?
Well, you need to have bollards in front of hotels so trucks cannot plow into them with explosives. You need to have, if you have security cameras, which they all have, you need to have enough people watching the security cameras. Most of the security cameras are there to go back to after something happened rather than determine that something is happening.
Just having somebody watching is sufficient. They have to know.
Absolutely right. And I saw right. some of that not happening. Teaching maintenance staff, if they see something, say something. For example, if they see a lot of AAA or AA batteries in bags in somebody's room, well, what do you use AAA and AA batteries? What do you use a lot of AAA and AA?
10,000 of them.
Yes, or not even that many, but you would use them to for bombs and explosives.
How about the case at in Vegas? Or that guy got so much upstairs. It was
oh,
ridiculous.
My God, absolutely right. Nobody was, well, you know, from what I understand, people could have been paying much more attention when one guy is coming in with bag after bag after bag and nobody's questioning. So the level of security that has to go into hotels at different levels, one of the first things is for American hotels, do you lower the American flag? Do you provide a little less visibility? The more security you have that's visible to a terrorist, the less likely that will become a target. They'd rather go for easier targets.
Because they'll see the security.
They'll see this. You want visible security.
Yeah.
So that's what will work into Red Hotel, which ultimately is a Putin-esque story about trying to reclaim, going back to what we were talking about before, going back to trying to reclaim the satellite countries that they had in the Cold War. Well, if they had Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, Ukraine, Poland, could have that bumper again, as well as the resources, their national resources, Russia would have a lot better economy and be a huge global threat again militarily.
Can you name offhand, because I certainly can't, but I had a conversation with a gentleman from one of these places, the countries that are around Afghanistan. There's follow a security guard or security personnel up in Stevenson Ranch, California. And he was saying that that's where he was from, one of these countries that's next to Afghanistan. And he says, we've had nuclear power, incredible infrastructure, thriving economy, thriving businesses, streets, everything modern. Afghanistan looks like the Stone Age, and no one mentions what's around it and how well they're doing.
Absolutely right, including India and Pakistan, and the power. They are nuclear powers.
Yeah.
It's a world that we have to pay more attention to.
What scares you as an American? What scares you about this country?
About America?
About what could happen?
Well, you know, I remember when, as most of us do, civics were taught in schools. We understood what our responsibility, and education had more value, and I think education has been greatly devalued. Mm-hmm. So what scares me is that we have a generation of people who... or a couple of generations of people now who will listen only to the news that they want to listen to.
Bingo!
And they're
it's
not...
no longer newspapers or magazines. You find out what people want to read and then give it to them.
Absolutely.
Hey, we're going to take a break for about 60 seconds. We'll be right back.
Turn the radio on, this is the meltdown. Get out the camera, take a picture. Queens and the freaks are all out on the town. A cowboy chains in bed, a nurse in a
take your smoking, drinking, interrupting obsession with you 24 hours a day on any phone or device. And it's all free. Just go to your friendly app store and search for Outlaw Radio. Then look for the red letters on the sign with the bullet holes in it and download it. It's free. Listen free on the road, in your car, at the beach, or in your backyard. It's all free from Outlaw Radio.
This is Buddy Twist saying goodnight from Hollywood.
Back to True Crime Uncensored.
Like that echo?
Yeah, it's great. With who?
With the legendary Burl Bear.
Was that right?
Yeah. And you, Howard Lapidus.
With Burl Bear and Howard Lapidus.
Yeah, I told you. You didn't believe me at first, but I just validated it.
I believe.
Also, what's his name in the corner, whose microphone is thankfully not working with Beans? Mark C.G. Boyer.
I'm tired every week of having to work on that. If he can't figure it out for himself, that's it. I have no more time for this.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, see now it's working. He can't. There's
all these years.
It's such an easy concept. You get up to that damn mic and you speak into it.
That's correct. We do sometimes actually want to hear what you have to say. Not all the time.
No, you're very seldom, as a matter of fact.
Featuring Mark C.G. Boyer.
See, you're on the masthead.
Yeah.
Did you see that? That's you.
And today's program is recorded and archived by Douglas Shearer. Thank you very much, Douglas.
Thank you very much, Douglas.
Yeah. I've got to find someone else to do that after now.
He quit.
No, he's retired.
Gary will do it.
Yeah, he retired. We'll get someone to do it. We're talking to Gary Grossman. This is usually part of the program, Gary, where I take 30 to 60 seconds to tell people to buy all my books.
Do it.
So I'll tell you, buy all my books. And we got that out of the way.
And where do they find your books?
They find my books the same place they find yours. So while you're buying his, you could buy mine. My latest masterpiece is, of course, Betrayal in Blue, the true story of the cocaine cops of the NYPD. They weren't afraid of the cops because they were the cops, making, 13,000 a year as NYPD police, and $8,000 a week providing protection for the Dominican drug cartel. The story was written with Ken Urell, one of the two most disgraced cops in the history of the NYPD. And you'll get a kick out of this. He kept a diary, which would be like a confession if the cops got their hands on it, when he was raided, not by the NYPD, because they knew what he was doing for years. They didn't say anything about it because they didn't want a scandal. So it wasn't until he went to Long Island that they got popped. When they found his diary, they didn't think it was anything, and they just tossed it in the air. So years later, now there's a documentary out called The 7-5, and he wanted to turn into a book, and
it's
contacted.
HBO.
We were able to use his memoirs as the foundation for the book.
And what's the name of the book again?
Betrayal in Blue. I call it Sophie's Choice to Squad Car. Because he had to, if he betrayed his partner, he'd already betrayed the badge, but if he testifies or becomes a cooperating witness against his partner, cops don't like that.
No.
But it was the only way he could save his partner's life. So it was a damned if you do, damned if you don't. He didn't want his partner to get killed and spend the rest of his life in prison, so he had to turn a cooperating witness, not an informant, a cooperating witness, to save his partner's life.
And people were willing to talk to you openly?
The head of the Dominican drug cartel called to make sure we portrayed him accurately.
Wait. I just thought you said the head of the Dominican drug cartel called, had your number, which already worries me, had your
we
number.
We made sure he had the
to
number.
Make sure. Fact-checking?
Yes.
Okay. When you picked up the phone and you found out who he was, what did you say?
You'll have
to ask.
Nowhere
near Oakland?
No. He was in the Dominican Republic.
Uh-huh.
He did about 7-8 years in prison here and then was deported. Multi-millionaire, as you can well imagine.
How did you fact-check this guy when he's just the guy on the phone?
Well, it was Frank Girardo who handled that aspect of it. And it was a very distinctive voice. He's also in the documentary.
I've got to see it. Read it.
Yeah, see the documentary, read the book. The book goes into things the documentary doesn't.
Are you in the documentary as well?
No. It was after the documentary was already done that Ken Urell, who was one of the main characters in the documentary, went to Paul Guzzo in Florida and said, where do I get a true crime writer to turn my memoir into a book? And he said, legendary Burl Bear, raised on record, born to rock and roll.
So to Howard's question to me, what scares you?
What scares me is the intentional ignorance and lack of consultation on the part of American people. Mm-hmm. forming opinions before they have facts.
Yes.
Consultation, problem solving, no matter what it is three parts. One, ascertain data, facts, information. Same thing when we're doing a book. You do the research. You get the accurate information devoid of opinion. Then you find the legal, ethical, moral, spiritual, whatever it is, principle, ethical principle, and you apply that principle to the data to arrive at your course of action or form your opinion or whatever you're going to do. If you start in the process having the opinion, you've already screwed the whole thing up.
You've got blinders on.
Yeah.
I what I found, and I think I learned it from my dad in law enforcement in New York State. I love James Bond. I love superheroes. I love we always talk about the Saint. And I do want to actually come back to the Saint because I saw the new BBC series a while ago, about two years ago.
We have the world's foremost.
I know. It was rebooted, so I want to come talk about that. But what I learned and what I try to do in my books is that it does take, and it's probably what didn't happen on 9/11. It takes you who know something, I who know something, Howard, everybody getting together and sharing the information and then vetting it, determining what part of the story do each of us have that can give us enough intel to move forward.
That's called being united in your views and thoughts with your purposes harmonized. Even if you have totally different perspectives, like the blind man and the elephant, you have totally different perspectives, yet your overarching goal is exactly the same.
So how would you guys go about vetting the crazy op-ed that was in the New York Times
about
the White House?
And I do want to go back in a second. I want to go back and talk to you about the blind man and the elephant, because I use that story in Red Hotel. And people who don't know it, you should tell the story. It's wonderful. The op-ed, I'm of two minds. It to some extent, it's not telling, in my mind, us anything we didn't know. But I think if that person is so passionate about it, we don't need a shadow government inside the United States, unelected, correcting and
the elected
process.
Official, that's correct.
Absolutely. He should or she should go public and say to the United States Senate and Congress, I am going to testify. I want a hearing. I want to testify. If you do not have the hearing for me to speak, then I will go to the press. But this is where it needs to be heard, because otherwise we're
just floating in the air.
Absolutely
thing.
Right. And we didn't elect that person or those people there. And yes, last November, I went to the Reagan National Forum at the Reagan Library, meeting people, research. And I had a very strong feeling that in seeing secretaries of the Army and the Navy, people very high up in the White House, and I really had a strong sense that there were intelligent people there who had control of things. But do we want them protecting us from somebody who they're not showing faith in? Whoever leaked that story should go public.
Well, this isn't the first time.
No.
This isn't the first time. I have friends who, what's his name, Frank Hagen, might tell you the same thing, because he worked in the Reagan White House one time. I have also other had friends who worked in the Reagan White House who said that he was already senile and demented in his first term, that he would be walking into the White House in his pajamas, dazed and confused. They go, it's time to play the president. He put the makeup on. He says, I'm playing the president now. And he would play the president.
And, Burl, you want to believe that.
Well, the people, it's not an insult to Reagan.
No, of course it's an insult to Reagan.
Well, why is it an insult to him? It's not his fault.
You got a guy in his pajamas, for crying out loud.
It's not his fault.
The president of the United States in pajamas. But
that's not an insult.
For you to make a ludicrous statement that is not an insult to our president.
It's not. It's an insult to the United States government that when you have that situation, you're supposed to do something about it.
Once again, hearsay, but you adore that because
it fits
your scenario of who that man is.
I felt sorry for the gentleman.
Which is sort of where we were starting with this.
Right.
Like, stick with the facts instead of hearsay. And Gary makes a very valid point. this broad or this guy or whoever.
Yeah, I agree with him on that.
Come out of the shadows and be a man or a
woman.
Right.
Or a combination of the two.
In this day and age.
Yes, yes. But it seems to me like, assuming, for example, that if my friends who worked in their first-person narrative, while it's hearsay to me, it's first-person to them, if they were correct, then what would have done? I mean, they're doing everything they could to protect him, which I thought was nice, and to protect the country, which I thought was nice. But then again, our Constitution has ways of dealing with that exact situation.
And that's not the way.
Right, right.
So it was wrong then.
Mm-hmm.
If it's true, it's wrong now. If it's not true, then not true. I mean, who knows? We don't really know except for symptomology.
I would like to return to a time where the president is the president of the United States, not the president of one political party. And I felt that was very much the case with Obama, because there was so much disunity and dissension from Republicans. And I feel that now with Trump, because he's the president of the Republican Party. And I'm trying to remember. I think there was a time when Reagan was president of the United States. I think there was a time when George Bush, after 9/11, was president of the United States. How long has it been since we've had 4 or 8 years where somebody truly was seen as the president of the United States?
It's kind of like a scorpion and the frog story, you know.
That's the other story.
Really? You know, it's by nature. Partisan politics, by its very nature, is divisive and corrupt in ever higher and ever widening circles, avoided as you would a lion.
And tell the story about the elephant and the blind man.
Well, you got an elephant. You got five guys. They're all blind. Each one's going to touch a different part of the elephant, and they're going to say, "Oh, it's this way. It's big and thick." And then someone grabs his tail, and goes, "Oh, it's thin and waggly."
It's a flower.
But if you put all the perspectives together, you're going to get a picture. Like a variety of security cameras at a hotel. You can't just have one security camera. You have to have all of them.
That's
and combine
right.
and collaborate and cross-reference all the available information.
And if you see something, say something. I think that's the most important phrase.
If you don't see something, don't make it up.
Exactly. I've told people, these days...
Gary, it's political correctness that doesn't allow that see something, say something. You know that. This overwrought political correctness gets in the way.
Because you're afraid if you bring it up, then I may risk my job.
You're blasphemized. Mm-hmm. And you're a racist.
Right.
And you may lose your job.
Right.
In this climate, you may lose your job.
And that prevents...
The right thing from happening.
Right.
What's that?
Or protection. Or the wrong thing from happening.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. One of the hotels we went to, in the service elevators, big posters for the staff. If you see something, say something. But that's no good if they're not taught what to look for.
Yes.
So what should they be looking for? That was my question.
Well, they need to be looking for electronic equipment. They need to be looking for batteries, as I talked about. They need to be looking for when somebody checks into someplace, and it doesn't have to be a hotel. It could be an office building. If somebody is spotting where the surveillance cameras are, you should be concerned about that.
They might be a security expert.
They could be, but they might be somebody else.
Now, that gets really scary to me, because when I go into a bank or anything like that, because I'm a true crime writer, I'm always looking at where the security cameras are. I don't have no intention of robbing the bank.
No.
Or our friend O'Reilly, who used to rob banks.
The fact that you're in a bank has got everybody out of it.
Yeah, because what the hell is he doing? He has no money. He's an author.
Or if you come back at the same time every day. All those kinds of things are
my
signals.
My mom did that, but that's another story. I worked for banks for 20 years. And I did a lot of fraud detection. And we were, Home Savings at the time was having a lot of teller fraud. And we had a big meeting, and they were describing the different kinds of fraud. And they wanted to know what they could do about it. And little pipsqueak Markey raises his stupid hand and says, "Hey, why aren't we training the tellers to recognize these issues?"
Duh.
And who trains them, though? Somebody from the outside has to come in.
The banks had security department and experts.
Mm-hmm.
And they were more than capable of doing reasonably sized training segments to describe fast change issues and check fraud and so forth. They were able to do that.
So did they do that based on you raising your hand?
A version of it got implemented eventually.
I thought it was fascinating, and I don't know if you were here, Mark, we had a bank security expert on the show who was saying when the bank's robbed or the guy hits the button, it rings in India. Honest to God, rings in India, and then India calls the local bank to see if it's real, and if it's real, then...
Oh, my God. There's something wrong with that system. Do you know that after 9-11, the Pentagon and the White House called in thriller writers... Screenplay writers.
To
we start had somebody who on
Lee
show.
Goldberg, my nephew.
Oh, you're
great. He wrote the book called True Fiction. That's exactly that plot.
Because they had to get from somebody what are the possibilities and the things we're not thinking
so
about.
So where were you on 9/11? I know you're in New York.
I was in New York, Upper East Side, that morning. And the very first thing Rob and I did, we went down and we got money out of an ATM and we got water. We were thinking earthquake.
Yeah.
What do you do?
How did you hear? You heard about it?
Well, that morning on the news, I had the morning news on the local TV One, the local New York news, and the big story on TV One, I'm not kidding, was as it was presented as a huge danger. Do you know that when you flush the toilet, germs will fly up at least 7 feet high? So when you flush the toilet, stand away from... That was 1 hour before the first plane hit.
Yep. And you got to know what to be afraid of.
But they were with it when the first plane hit.
Yes, yeah.
And that's what you saw.
I did not see the first plane hit. I saw the second plane hit.
And that inspired you to get water and cash.
Water and cash. And then we went downstairs, and we were staying at a Marriott hotel. And within 1 hour, we saw security... At the hotel, we saw you had to present identification to go upstairs. They had bomb-sniffing dogs, all of these part of the threat assessment. By the way, bomb-sniffing dogs, they're good for about 45 minutes, and then they begin to lose the scent. And cold, extreme cold, can throw them off the scent.
Also, if you spray them with that ozone stuff.
Yeah, that's not a good thing. Is that what Howard has right here?
It's ozone.
That's ozone.
Yeah, if you do that, that's really a cruel thing to do to a dog.
But it'll take their nose right
totally,
out of
them. Totally, yeah, take it right out of them.
So what happened was that we got prepared. And fire engines were screaming downtown. Police cars were screaming downtown, and nothing was coming back up.
Where did you bunker down?
We were at 57th and Lexington, the Upper East Side. But later in the day, people were walking up in the middle of the street, soot all over them, silent. Now, I've only been in New York where there's no noise, and you can hear a conversation across the street. It's when there's a snowstorm, because there's no traffic, and it was on 9/11. It was... I was saying eerie. It's that is
also
inconsequential.
Thanos, when Thanos came with his giant spaceship,
that would have happened day too.
Yeah,
but that's those are images that shape me as a writer. We were driving back to California, talking with the History Channel, saying we need to have a show on about the history of civil defense in America. We need to have a show on the times America has actually been attacked by a foreign government, and there have been times.
Japan and Germany during World War II.
During World War II. Off of Goleta.
Yes.
1941, Steven Spielberg.
Get the balloon bombs.
In the Northwest.
Hey, Gareth.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you for doing
thank
this.
Thank you, too.
Hey, Matt, if you want to fact check my statement about Reagan, look over in the Washington
I don't need to fact check hearsay. I understand it.
Go to the Washington Post and you will discover.
Oh, wait, Washington Post. Excellent source. Thank you.
He doesn't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it.
Stop with the fighting. Stop with the fighting.
It's not fighting. I was just going to give him a hint. What's next? More lack of rational thought.
Are you going to thank the guest?
Of course I'm going to thank the guest. I'd like to thank all five blind men and the elephant and Gary Grossman for being our guest on True Crime Uncensored.
Thank you.
Next, Magic Matt Allen and the Demon of Decadence. Live at Al Radio, live.com.
Who do we have? We have a Carradine.
That's
on the show.
Which Carradine?
We have Robert Carradine.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, on Outlaw Radio. All that and much less in mere minutes on the Big Dog of Broadcasting.
I was cold.
What the watch?
In my-